When you hear the word torture, chances are you think of horrific physical pain. But a lot of torture doesn't touch the body, it torments the mind. And since psychological torture is intangible, it's often thought to be less serious than physical torture, or even not torture at all. But a new book makes the case that psychological torture is, in fact, detectable, harmful, and cruel. The book is called The Trauma of Psychological Torture. Its editor is Almarindo Ojeda, a professor at UC Davis. He joins us by phone from Peru. Almarindo Ojeda, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
What is psychological torture? Give us a couple of examples of what constitutes psychological torture.
Well, psychological torture is a practice that's more prescribed than it is defined, because it seems to require us to solve a couple of very difficult problems, namely, what is pain, what is mental pain in particular, and how much of it do you need to have in order to qualify as psychological torture. One of the things I've been thinking about and appears in this book you introduced today is that one way to get around these difficult issues is to define the practice by the kinds of activities or other practices it involves. For example, isolation, sensory deprivation, sensory overload, severe forms of humiliation, and so on. This, I think, is a more productive way of defining psychological torture, one that doesn't require us to look into the intentions that people have in producing it, but rather at the actual behavior that people display.
But if we don't know what the result is in the person who's experiencing the psychological torture, how do we know that what was done to them was serious enough to be called torture?
Oh, we know because we can talk to the victims of the practice, and they describe it as horrific. We even have examples of people who have undergone both the physical and the psychological torture, like Senator McCain, for example. And according to many, including him, he'd rather have the physical kind of torture before he had more of a psychological one.
Why is that?
Well, the problem with pain is a mental reality. It's not a physical one. We feel like we feel the pain in our arm or our leg, but it's really the brain that's in pain. So you can produce suffering without touching the body. Examples are these severe forms of sensory deprivation that we have been sadly familiar with. It's not entirely clear why it's so horrific, but there's no doubt that it is. There's been research going back to the 50s establishing this. So these are the practices that we've become familiar with, things like hooding and goggling and even heavy gloves on your arms. Sometimes even surgical masks. The idea is to cut you off from your sensory environment, from sensory input. And it seems that that produces a very severe form of panic that people suffer.
My guest is Almarindo Ojeda. He's editor of the new book, The Trauma of Psychological Torture. He also wrote its introduction. He's a professor at UC Davis and director of the campus's Center for the Study of Human Rights in the Americas. He joins us from Peru. Tell us about how humiliation fits in as a form of psychological torture, because I'm just guessing that a lot of people go, well, humiliation, that can be unpleasant, but how could humiliation ever be a form of torture?
It's all a matter of degrees. It's one thing to insult you in some way, and it's another to severely put you in a place. I mean, we're talking about cases like we saw in the Abu Ghraib pictures where an interrogator or a guard places a leash around the prisoner's neck and parades him around as a dog, or forces them to roll on excrement, or places what the prisoner thinks is led to believe that has menstrual blood on his face. These really abhorrent practices are much more than just, you know, a down-putting remark.
What about tough interrogation? It seems to me that when people are interrogated legally, it often uses forms of psychological isolation, coercion. How do we know when something moves from tough interrogation to psychological torture?
Well, there's two kinds of interrogation, two schools of interrogation. The coercive kind of interrogation, that's what we've been talking about, and the rapport building kind of interrogation. The idea that you can get more information and more reliable information simply by building links to the interrogatee by offering them incentives or by approaching him at the more humane level. And FBI interrogators, for example, that need to produce information that stands in court believe as a whole that that's the way to go, whereas other interrogations try to get at more actionable intelligence more quickly, not realizing that the kind of information is not reliable. Both are psychological, but one is vastly more useful than the other, let alone more ethical and more legal than the other.
We're talking about psychological torture. My guest is Almarindo Ojeda, UC Davis professor. When someone has been physically tortured, there is probably quite often, maybe even always, some physical traces of it, and you can see what was done and what impact, physical impact it had on the person. How often is psychological torture detectable and even provable after the fact?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, that's exactly the goal of this research we've embarked on. What we want to do in collaboration with our colleagues at the Center for Mind and Brain here at UC Davis is to try and find a set of diagnostics for psychological torture, which will be as reliable as, say, cigarette marks on the body is. The reason why cigarette marks are not used in democracies when they torture is that they leave these very identifiable marks. But psychological torture to date has not displayed a set of reliable diagnostics. Now, there are some interesting indicators that point to potential areas. There's a group in Constance, Germany, that's working exactly on this issue. We have an article from them in our volume called Tortured Brains. What they're trying to do is get brain scans of victims of torture and try to identify areas that behave or look differently from normal or untortured brains.
Meaning that there's damage to the central nervous system?
Sorry?
Meaning that there's damage to the central nervous system?
That's the idea, some kind of actual physical scars that you could see in the brain as a result of this. I mean, it's still very much cutting-edge work. It's not reliable by any long shot at this point, but that's why we are a research university. We're trying to figure this one out.
What about long-term harm to victims of psychological torture? Are there any common signs of long-term harm that you see in people who've been tortured in this way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a very common practice. Interestingly, not just for the victim, but also for the perpetrator. These are conditions that last very long. You see, from a scientific point of view, a memory is just a configuration of neurons. That's a physical thing. It's the way neurons are connected to each other. So it should be possible, albeit extremely challenging, to figure out what particular connections of neurons correspond to a case of severe humiliation. At this point, this is almost science fiction, but scientifically, that has to happen. And being such a resilient memory, the memory of torture being so resilient, it should be in some way easy to discover that configuration of neurons. It's just that we don't know exactly how to look for it. But if we're on the right path, it should pop out very quickly and very easily.
You mentioned the perpetrator. Can they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder as well?
Absolutely. Some people do. Others try to distance themselves from the practice by professionalizing it, and that's one of the insidious aspects of psychological torture. It's been developed by PhDs, by psychologists, and then they give the practice the veneer of professionalism and research and even medical aseptics. But people who realize what they're doing do suffer long-lasting effects of this.
You're the editor of the book, The Trauma of Psychological Torture. You are, though, a professor of linguistics at UC Davis.
That's right. How does
a linguist get into this line of work?
Good question. Well, before I'm a linguist, I'm a human being first. I suppose that's what moved me in this direction. I got involved into creating this Center for the Study of Human Rights in the Americas once we started discussing in polite company whether torture was worth it. It isn't. We never talk about whether rape is worth it, that it might have some effect, some beneficial effect somewhere. We never raise that issue. I think the same should hold with torture. There's no situation that should license it. So, and then after the fact, I'm discovering all sorts of interesting uses of language surrounding torture to mask it rather than reveal the practice that I as a linguist have an ear for.
We don't have time to go into it in any detail whatsoever, but I'm just curious to hear just a little bit about what you do as a linguist. I read that you construct theories about what's in common among languages that appear to be unconnected. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm a semanticist, which is a much maligned field. When people hear the word semantics, they think of how to fool other people by drawing distinctions that don't correspond to any differences. But semantics is really the study of meaning, and meaning is what language is for. We speak to convey ideas, things, thoughts, beliefs, rather than just to produce funny noises or construct complicated phrases. So I've been looking at all sorts of different things. One is that I'm interested in is the meaning of nouns in general. Nouns are, we're told, names of persons, places, and things, but there's scores of persons, places, and things that never get any name. Why is that? Which ones get a name, and why do they get a name as opposed to a myriad other possibilities and never get named?
And what about unconnected languages like Breton and Arabic? Are there commonalities among
Absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely. Those two languages, for example, classical Arabic, for example, has a dual form of number on the noun that's for exactly two of something. So if in classical Arabic you want to say my arms ache, since you only have two of them, you use neither the singular nor the plural. You use the dual. And Breton has the same kind of construction.
Is that just a coincidence, or do you think they're somehow actually related?
I would think so. Yes. I don't think they were related or influenced even by each other. It's not an unusual feature to have a duo. Many languages do. Australian languages do. Classical Greek had it too. It's sort of a natural thing if you can think of it. I mean, think of the word pair.
Yeah.
We have a word pair for twosomes, not for 35-somes.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Almerindo Ojeda, professor of linguistics at UC Davis and director of the campus's Center for the Study of Human Rights in the Americas. We talked with him because he's the editor of the new book, The Trauma of Psychological Torture. Almerindo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ.